your source for everything paranormal. Para-X. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Explore the second edition of the Witch's Oracle deck through 45 innovative cards and enhanced guidebook that peers into the world of the witch. The deck's stunning artwork has a new look and includes 7 brand new inspirational cards. Each card now includes a suggested crystal or gemstone to enhance your reading, as well as a magical incantation that provides energy, reinforces the card's meaning, and helps the desired message to be sent out into the universe. The easy-to-navigate guide also has a new look and offers straightforward, gentle guidance that takes readers through both good times and bad, and now includes a chapter on crystal and gemstone divination by the amazing Nicholas Pearson. The Witch's Oracle. It is a perfect divination deck for witches as well as non-pagans, and is designed to suit both seasoned readers and beginners alike. Find out more about the Witch's Oracle deck at www.marlabrooks.com, and you can purchase the deck from schifferbooks.com, amazon.com, or order a copy from your favorite bookseller.
Hey, merry meet everybody, and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron here on the Para-X Radio Network. The opening music tonight was called Deep Trouble by Midnight Syndicate. And my guest tonight, author, spiritual medium, paranormal researcher, and investigator Jill Marie Morris, found herself in deep trouble from the moment she and her husband moved into a new apartment. Now, Jill ordinarily uses her unique sense of abilities to help others, but tonight, we're going to be talking about a personal account of a terrifying series of events in her life when she lived in upstate New York that took place in the late 1980s. The emotional and horrifying journey involved love, paranormal phenomenon, and demonic possession. And sadly, it ended in tragedy and forever changed her life. And at the same time, it strengthened her spirituality. So we're going to jump into it because there's a lot to cover. So Jill, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Marla, for having me. I really appreciate it.
And I thought we were going to be in deep trouble for a while.
I did too. Traffic. That LA traffic is terrible.
I know. Well, you were just meant to make it just by the skin of your teeth. So this is always a good thing. But before we get into the story, let's talk a little bit about your background as a medium. Have you been mediumistic all your life, and had you encountered maybe the dark side before, either in practice or on investigations, or was this all kind of out of left field and blindsiding at the same time?
Good questions. I actually, from childhood, found out that I was a medium and psychic, and come from a long line maternally of psychic mediums on the maternal side. My great-great-grandmother was full-blooded Chippewa Native American, and she was actually a medicine woman for her tribe that migrated down from Canada into Western New York State. And she married a full-blooded Seneca Iroquois Indian. And actually, it's very interesting because the two Iroquois Seneca and the Chippewa Algonquian tribes, it was really considered taboo for the two different tribes to marry. The Iroquois thought the Algonquians really had lost their minds because they were very much into the spiritual, mystical things that they were really terrified of. If you do research on what went on between their beliefs, the two different values, considering they were both Native American, but they married and Gertrude basically was apparently one heck of a psychic medium and skipped over my great-grandmother and my grandmother. My mom's mom was incredibly gifted as well. She predicted the Kennedy assassination, which my grandfather actually was not in the army at the time, but he had served in the army and he was, you know, it really freaked him out. And it was something that he, she made the prediction and he basically told her, do not speak that in my house ever again. And when it happened, it really rattled him. She had pretty much the details down. So skipped my mom and landed in my lap right after my first grandfather died. My paternal grandfather passed away in 1967, actually May of 1967 to be exact, and I have very vivid memories just before 2 is my most early validated memory, but when he passed, people were, you know, mourning him, and he was coming to me, and that's how the whole thing got started. And it's gone on since then.
So what were your thoughts about the devil or demons in general before moving into 207?
Well, I was raised Roman Catholic for most of my adult life, and then I left because the older that I got and actually going through the experience at 207 really made me see that there was so much more than what we were being taught specific to one religion. And I had always kind of implemented my grandmother, who also ended up going from being raised Native American to a Catholic orphanage and then raised Catholic. So she balanced it out and taught me how to foster both those beliefs. But as an adult going through what I did, it really made me realize that there's so much more than to when you say the devil, or, you know, a lot of people automatically think of a figure with horns and a pitchfork, and it's just so much more involved in symbolic and not so specific to that one, if you want, caricature. But I was taught to be afraid of evil. But yet at the same time, my grandmother also taught me not to fear. So it's a really interesting dynamic growing up. You know, you should more so be very grounded in your belief and protect yourself, I guess, would be a good way to put it, and show no fear to the darker things.
Exactly. I mean, sometimes it's hard not to, but, you know, it's just one of those things that, that evil comes in many forms.
It does.
And, yeah. And I mean, the Christian version of the devil may very well be what some people believe, but I think evil is what you believe it is, you know, personal belief systems. And you have to trust your gut. You know, if you see a clown walking down the street, most people are going, oh, look, a clown, yay. Other people are going to think, oh, my God, that's pure evil.
My daughter-in-law would die.
Yeah, exactly. So evil is in the mind of the person who's trying to identify it. But I have to say that I had trouble putting down the book once I got started. And, you know, sometimes it's difficult to get through a whole book for a weekly show, you know. But this one, I could not put it down because it read well. It's an easy read, but the story was very, very compelling. So I think let's set the stage. When and where did these series of events begin?
In 1988, my husband and I was 5 months pregnant, we started to transition over to be closer to the city of Albany, which is the capital of New York. And so it was kind of a big move for us. And we actually lucked out because a very good friend of ours lived next door to, well, behind this house that had an apartment that became vacant. And we thought, and the wife, who was a very good friend of mine, still is, had a daycare. And she was like, I'm going to watch the baby when you go back to work. And this was like the perfect setting. Mm-hmm. So we went right before we went to look at the house. I started picking up on something. I knew something was off. Went into the house. I knew right away. I was like, something's wrong here. And immediately, even touching the banister, walking up the stairs, it was like a jolt just going through me. And mm-hmm. I knew someone had passed. I knew there was at least one spirit that was immediate coming into the second floor flat. There were three apartments. And that part of it ended up, I didn't want to move there. The impressions were so strong and so severe and so negative and dark, and we fought about it. And prior to moving in, I started having a sequence of dreams. It would be like a little snippet. Like, I remember the first night was just like a little glimpse, and it woke me up terrified. And then the next night, a couple nights, there were like multi-parts. You know how you fall back asleep and then it's almost a continuation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it ended up over several days being very foreboding of what actually happened just about a year later. And it was horrible. Moving into the house, which was a big decision, I had to forego the emotional aspect and really do what my grandmother said, which was don't be afraid. But she didn't have a good feeling either. And I thought it was the best situation. I had to forego the emotional aspect of it and do what I thought was right, you know, for babysitter, my friend is next door. This is so convenient to work for both of us. And boy, it was, it was all but that. And, as time went on, it really, that was like May of 1988. And by July 4th, there was some pretty heavy activity starting to pick up in the house that impacted more so my husband and anybody that would come into the house. It was very angry energy. Mm-hmm. And one of my husband's very good friends had slept on the couch, and he was terrified. He had a dream that a man came up to the side of the couch. He said it was vivid to him. It was like he was not dreaming, that he was really there, and tried to get him to jump out the second floor window. Mm-hmm. And my husband thought it was funny, but yet my husband's behavior was at that point, because in the book, we were coming back from a 4th of July picnic, and out of nowhere, he literally, and I'm pregnant, like not just a little, but a lot pregnant here, and barely sitting behind the dashboard, and he played chicken in the middle of the road with another car. And his whole mannerisms, what came over him, I will never forget. I hope I don't see anything like what took place in that year again. Mm-hmm. And it escalated with time. It became more violent. He became more strange. He did not have a history of mental illness. He was a social drinker. He socially smoked pot, being perfectly honest.
Yeah.
So, you know, and as far as I'm concerned, I've never seen pot make somebody go stark raving crazy, bonkers, you know, totally off their rocker, where their facial expression distorts, their pupils in their eyes dilate. It was the freakiest thing I ever saw. And it wasn't even relative to the times he smoked pot. These were just, you would never know when these changes would come about, other than in time, it just got really, really bad.
Mm-hmm. You know, and as time progressed, there were symptoms of some kind of evil infestation, let's call it that, beginning mm-hmm. to appear. I mean, and as I'm reading the book, it's the kind that we hear about in other negative entity situations. One of them was a phantom odor that cleared out the whole building practically because it was really bad. And then by the time that happened, you'd had other hints of something bad going on. Like you said, your dreams, your husband's personality change, his friend's dreams while sleeping on the couch. Did you ever consider the fact that there was the possibility of a, let's just use the word demonic because it's the catch-all word, or did you perhaps think it was just maybe a disgruntled spirit at work?
Well, that's a great question that I am often asked, and my response is it's not necessarily one way or another other than for me at that point at 22 years old, it had to be the first real, truly, I'm going to say, dark and demonic energy. Now, I did not classify it as such. My grandmother kept saying something's wrong here. She wouldn't even talk about the house. She would say she'd pray for the house or she'd chant for the house and us for our safety. But she was, you know, locked down, drag out. She had a very bad feeling. And I'm like, I just have to get through this day to day. So I was kind of floundering, like, what is this? But demonic did not come up, actually, until our family priest mentioned it right after my husband died. So he had more knowledge of what had gone on in that house and in the direct vicinity of the house and never had shared that with us until after he died. But yes, I did know there was something very dark and evil, and taught by my grandmother how to block. I call it blocking or grounding, centering and blocking from a very young age. That's all I did. I would sage the house. I would bless the house. I would, we had to, it was awful because I tried to get the priest over to bless the house and he was very close to my husband and I, he was like family to us. And every I did not know at the time, and this is explained in the book, that my husband was undermining the situation. And it was, it made it difficult because there is a line drawn in the sand where, with the escalation and violence, it, I want to call it a slow boil. He crossed a line and I moved out. That was when he hit me. And it wasn't, you know, the second time. It was the first time I sailed across the room and basically knocked out flat, cold. And I went and lived with my mother. And that probably was a blessing in disguise because I got out of the house with my son. But he stayed there. So it did not end for him well, as described.
Actually, not well at all. And there were hints around, like, you, all right, when you first moved in there, there was a spot in the middle of the living room floor that looked like it had been
sanded down.
And then there were also a pair of footprints, like, heading out the door that kind of looked bloody.
That, there was, exactly, there was an area of the floor that beautiful, and this home was very well kept. Let me, it wasn't like a slum home. It was a beautiful old Victorian home and or neo-Gothic type style. And basically, the three apartments were very similar. The colors were a little bit different, but the floors were gorgeous hardwood floors. And in the front room was this large living room, and in the middle side of the living room floor was this area that was completely sanded down, like to the wood. And we always thought that was odd. He finished doing the floors, my husband did, but leading out from the living room, which were like a blonde colored flooring, into the dining room, which was a darker colored flooring stain, there was an even darker, it looked like bloody footprints of an old, all I can equate it to is like a nursing shoe, the very square heel-ish shoe leading out of the living room. And it was one set of footprints just leading out to the door, from the to the dining room and to the door. And there was nothing we could do to get those up. And you could tell they were quite old. Those bothered me a lot. We had things fall off the walls. Our wedding present, which was a beautiful, very ornate, hand-carved wooden vine with flowers on it. We had it on the wall in the other apartment, and not once did it fall. And no vibrations, it would just crash. No matter what, I tried putting it on three of the four walls. And it would not stay on the wall. I had a situation where flames shot out of the iron for no reason, out of the bottom of the iron, it literally sparked onto my shirt. Mm-hmm. And I threw everything in the sink. My best friend was attacked while she was babysitting my then infant son while we went out one night, and she was in nursing school and she would never go back in the house after that. Mm-hmm. That was a very traumatic experience for her. And we had my husband's very good friend who, after three times sleeping, the third time he said never again, because what happened on that night was we woke up and there was a huge amount of commotion. It sounded like several people tramping across a hardwood floor. It was just a huge scuffle. Mm-hmm. And Jim went flying out into the living room first, and I followed him. And Chris, his friend, was standing by the window shaking like a leaf, and he literally almost jumped out the window. But he said he was sleeping, and this man came to him, dragged him off the couch, and tried to push him out the window. Mm-hmm. And he said that was it. And sadly, my husband laughed at him again. Like, it was not him to do that. He was a very caring person by nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There were knockings that were going on that were unexplained, very peculiar issues with knockings. Mm-hmm. And the only apparition per se, because I was blocking and I was a little surprised when it happened, was Christmas Eve going into Christmas morning. It was kind of late. We'd put up the tree late, and I left the room and came back with some tea, and I describe it, I believe, in the book as like it was a puppet master controlling an apparition of a priest. I knew there was more to it.
Mm-hmm.
And he just, the look on his face when he manifested the evil, that was true evil that mm-hmm. was coming from him. And where he manifested, where the tree was, and if you go to the website, jillmariemorris.com, and you go to the books page and you scroll down to the bottom, you're going to see a bunch of actual pictures of my husband, Jim, and the inside of 207 in the outside of the house before the city did a revitalization project and tore the whole block down. But mm-hmm. where the Christmas tree was is actually where the priest appeared is where my husband died, where he committed suicide that 6 months later. And I cannot tell you, other than I know the priest was being controlled, and that kind of goes into the second book and actually goes mm-hmm. really into the third book that I've been working on. There's a lot more information that's come out relative to some things. So
mm-hmm.
that was the evil. Really, when I saw the priest, I knew that was when I definitely knew I looked at evil. But then taking over my husband in seeing him before he committed suicide that night when he tried to kill my mother and I and our infant son, it is something that you can't explain. Mm-hmm. You cannot explain the demeanor, the look, the tone. It's mm-hmm. almost as if it's a completely different, and I don't even want to say different person, because he was mm-hmm. not a person that night.
Right.
No,
I've seen that, and that's for another time. But I know exactly what you're talking mm-hmm. about. When I was reading the book, it sounded very familiar in some instances. And the thing too, the landlord, even before you moved in or right after you moved in, you asked the landlord if anybody had died in the apartment. And anything that you asked him, he just didn't really answer.
Not until after, 2 weeks right. after. When I had gone back to work, I got a phone call because I had to go get the last hit, because Jim stayed in 207, which is the night on June 28th of 1989, he came over for visitation. And my mother, who was a registered nurse at the time, supervised it because he had been arrested for assault on mm-hmm. me. And so she monitored everything. So she was home, and he was not acting right, and he asked to lay down after dinner, which was unusual, but he had showed up with two paper bags of toys, mm-hmm. and he wanted to wait and give the baby the toys after he took a nap, which was a very unusual request for him. So I woke him up and went back to my son in the high chair. And so he had all this time been living over in 207 and just coming to see us once a week. So when I turned to get my son out of the high chair that night, and I had him in my right arm, and I turned to my left to go towards the division between the dining room and the kitchen, he actually was about a foot and a half, 2 feet away from me with a loaded 12-gauge shotgun pointed right at my son and I. And it took my mother, truly did save us. It's not an embellishment. It was her nurse's training, because I was hysterical. Mm-hmm. I was absolutely hysterical. I was saying, shoot me, don't shoot my son, don't shoot the baby, let me put him down. I was trying, but I was screaming. All I can remember, yeah. I was hysterical. And my mother very calmly came out from the kitchen and utilized her training and was able to sort of diffuse the situation. And she literally came in and turned and shielded us. And it was a light switch moment where she reached him enough, whereas he put the gun to his side, and it was like he returned. All I can tell you, my mother and I talk about this even now, is mm-hmm. the way the switch, it was like a completely different transformation. He like registered, but he didn't say anything and he left. And that's where he went back to 207 and shot and killed himself. Mm-hmm. Now, that's where the 2 weeks later, the landlord called me and said, are you going to come over and get his things? And he goes, I can't believe this is happening again. And I'm like, happening again. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, when his brother Joe owned the house 30 years beforehand, there was a male that shot and killed himself in the living room mm-hmm. in the house. So that to me, Phil, the landlord, was a wonderful man, really, truly a wonderful man. And for whatever the reason, he may have felt the house wouldn't, you know, nobody would rent it if he had been up front with it.
Sure, yeah, obviously.
Especially yeah. to me, but I had picked up on something at that point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it sparked something in me that I said that I knew it, and I had to get to the bottom of it. And then as time went on with the discussion with our priest about what happened, we still had very heavy paranormal activity follow us to my mother's, which was extremely frightening.
Yes.
And that was where shortly thereafter our priest had, he pretty much spilled the beans with my grandmother and my mom and I, and he had said that he was aware of some of the history and some of the suicides and murders that had taken place, and he felt Jim had gone through at the very least an oppression, but more than likely a possession. And mm-hmm. that was where the whole demonic thing. I was like, what are you talking about? Because I'm like, you know, at 22, back in the 80s, the paranormal wasn't the paranormal. It was spooky talk or whatever.
Right.
But so, you know, I knew there were very bad and dark and evil things, but this was really the first time I ever heard that mentioned. And I just kind of, I had to process it because it was an education for me to learn about it. Mm-hmm. Kind of like a crash course. And
yeah,
that's why I said it totally reshaped my life as an adult.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I was going to bring up the fact that that entity, for lack of a better word, did follow you to your mom's house. And that in of itself, I mean, I would have like flipped out in a really bad way, because you think you're away from it.
Yep.
And you're not, you know, and you hear people that have moved from haunted houses or scary houses or whatever. A lot of people move away and the entity remains where it is. But there are some entities, and I've known of some cases like this, where it didn't matter where the person moved. They were followed.
Yeah. That's interesting, because I totally agree with you. And we were worried about that. We ended up just for like a day or two, we went up to my grandmother's in Granville, and the house was blessed in the whole nine yards, and we came back and it stopped. Now, what's interesting is it stopped, but when I remarried a couple years later, we had some situations take place in Western New York State, which actually come back tied to the priest, which is all discussed in book two about the history of the house and the residence and the 14 deaths that occurred in that house. It wasn't mm-hmm. just one male that died in the house of suicide. There was another male who hung himself from the third mm-hmm. floor in the center hallway. Mm-hmm. And then my husband died by gunshot, the same as the other man in the apartment. And then mm-hmm. there are 14 documented variety, most of them sudden deaths. There are some cancer. There are a couple cancers, mm-hmm. Some strange things that went on. But those are cited and documented with the obituaries and everything in book two. And mm-hmm. I know there are more. That's going to get discussed in book three and the entity itself, what I believe I figured out and why as of June 15th, to be exact, June 15th of 2015, why it's reared its ugly head, because there has been nothing since Western New York State until 2015. It was quiet and mm-hmm. all hell broke loose in June of 2015. And it's been interesting,
to say the least. And you know, somebody at one point said or suggested that the only way to save anybody is to tear down that house. Well, as you said, urban development, it came and they did tear it down, right?
They did. And what it does, I totally disagree with tearing it down and it's going to go away, because I've seen it happen the exact opposite, not just with me, but with other people, such as you had mm-hmm. mentioned. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole thing about haunted houses. It's really the environment, and especially these darker entities. Mm-hmm. When you I do believe 207 was a downflow vortex mm-hmm. and kind of added to the equation there. But once the containment, if you will, the house which contained that mm-hmm. was gone, it mm-hmm. just found the pharmacy behind the house, which was built, and it's hanging out there.
And it does move. I mean, you know, people think, oh my God, this is a brand new house. It can't be haunted. Well, you don't know what went on in that property 100 years ago, 200 years ago, or, you know, whatever. And you talk in kind of the epilogue in the book about the people at the pharmacy. I mean, it's, you know, like a regular old pharmacy parking lot, whatever. There are people that are dead scared to be in certain areas of the pharmacy. There are people that have had experiences, you know, that work there. Mm-hmm. It did. It had to find, because, you know, these things probably do feed off fear or whatever. So they need to, they're vampires. They need to find somebody's neck to suck. But that doesn't mean that they're still contained there. They can
move around. Absolutely.
Move around anywhere you want to go. You know, I always say when we pass, okay, so we didn't make it to the UK this time around, or we didn't get to go to Disneyland or whatever. the point is, when you're after you're gone, you can go. You know, you may not be able to sit there physically on the rides, but you can go anywhere. That's my belief anyway, that you can go anywhere you want to go and see anything that you want to see. You're not tied down, and you don't, you know, once you cross over, it doesn't mean that you can't come back. And
absolutely. And absolutely. Totally
that goes,
agree.
Right. That goes for the good guys and the bad guys. So, you know, the fact that these poor people that work in the pharmacy, and I'm not laughing, ha-ha, well, I sort of was for a minute. But, you know, can you just imagine you don't have a clue and you're working at your job and jobs are supposed to be safe and everything's fine. And all of a sudden something happens there that scares the bejesus out of you, and you won't go into a certain room or you won't go to a certain area. And, you know, it's vicious and vile. And can you get rid of things? I mean, I think in the book too, somebody said, well, you need to do an exorcism. You know, depending on what it is, that may or may not be the answer, right?
That's right. You're absolutely right. And you also, when you do exorcisms, and in the second book, I interviewed three priests from different dioceses, and really got a good handle on, just from the Catholic perspective, of a Catholic exorcism, you know, and discussed my situation. And everybody's on the same page where you have to be so careful, because it takes so much training to deal with these things. And just because you may expel something from someone, they're going to find somebody else. You don't know where they're going to go. And it's a dangerous game to play. And unfortunately, you know, my gut feeling was, I've got to call this pharmacy as I'm wrapping up book one and just get their spin on things. And they didn't know who I was. They didn't know the history of the house. Here I am calling just to say, hey, anything strange going on over there? I'm writing this book. And it turned into opening up a can of worms. And to this day, I get contacted by people that have had experiences while in the pharmacy or working in the pharmacy. And I'm not saying it's going to kill somebody. That's not it. Sticking to the facts as investigated and researched, there have been several employees that have exhibited the very same symptoms that Jim did, which was the split personality in a light switch moment and become violent, jumped over counters. And have been fired and become violent and totally out of character for these people. And then what I did find, which is going to be addressed in book three, is there is something very peculiar going on in that area of Watervliet on the second floor level. Okay. I'm not just talking where we lived. There have been many, many, many suicides that have taken place within direct vicinity of that house. And a lot of them, a higher number of them, have occurred on the second floor. A lot of the paranormal activity in the city occurs on the second floor. So there's some question of, could it be a portal, a big open portal that is at that level? But there is something that is keeping this energy pretty much contained. I mean, there have been, this will get addressed in book three, but some of the suicides, there have been people running in the middle of the street and shooting themselves. Just some really terrible, horrible things within close proximity of that house. That's just baffling.
Wow. And we do also need to kind of touch on the fact that you found out too late, and you couldn't have done anything about it anyway, that your husband had some issues when he was younger. And they kind of, the evil ones kind of prey on weaknesses. And absolutely. So maybe the people that kind of got taken over a little bit at the pharmacy, maybe they had issues, maybe they drank, maybe they did drugs, maybe they had some mental problems. And when you hear about all these cases, most of the time there is the person that is affected has had problems, not necessarily mental problems, but they have had things in their lives where they don't have the walls up. They're not, you know, the brave soldiers like we all try to be. They're vulnerable. And this is where these types of entities find an easy in.
Correct. And that's a great point, too, because it's a fracture. There's some type of fracture in the psyche, whether it's physically, mentally, emotionally, even spiritually, even sleep deprivation. I've heard, you know, talking with people over so many years, people are really heavily putting themselves on the line as far as, I'm not saying becoming possessed, but being affected in a darker energy entity situation, if they're sleep deprived, if they're not getting enough sleep, something as simple as that can cause an issue.
So, and like spirit, I mean, spirits are attracted to like personalities.
That's true. Very true. And it's just, you never know. It's kind of the interesting thing is some people, you know, commenting on the book, it's, I don't read the reviews anymore. when the book first came out, I did, but I just like, whatever. But it's interesting because some people are like, oh, there's hardly anything paranormal going on in there. I think it's this desensitization mm-hmm. that it's got to be, you know, creatures falling out of the ceiling, climbing up the walls. Like,
which has happened, you know, you never know. Yeah.
You never do know. Yeah. But it's kind of when you bring it down to the level of, that's what makes this so scary, is because it was subtle.
Mm-hmm.
It was a slow boil and it was extremely dangerous. Mm-hmm. And it did target, I do believe, the weaker people. And I don't mean any disrespect with that, even with my husband at all. It's just, again, agreeing with you with what you said, you know, there is some kind of in mm-hmm. for these energies to affect the living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, you moved in there for the right reasons, definitely.
Right.
But that for in general situations, you usually feel like that, you back away.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't trust their guts, though, or that they are sensitive to that. It's, you know, oh, okay, well, I watched this movie last night, and I'm a little jumpy today, so whatever this is because of that or whatever. It's very important for people to trust the feelings that they get. They may not be able to understand them. They may not know where they're coming from. But, you know, if something tells you to run, it's probably a good idea.
Yeah, Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, Marla.
No. It just, people don't trust themselves, and it's very hard, I think, for people to learn to do that.
It is, and I think the younger you are, in my case, like, because now I'd be like, I'm out of here. I don't care. You know, I learned. I've got the T-shirt for it, unfortunately. I'm done. Mm-hmm. And I really, if anything, it did teach me, I'm not afraid of the dead. I'm not afraid of evil. I block it. I don't want to deal with it. Mm-hmm. But the more you show the fear, like you said, the more trouble. And I don't think I was necessarily afraid. I just did not, even being a medium psychic at that age, I did not have an experience mm-hmm. of the intensity that I went through. And I often say, should I just have stood my ground and just, you know, but it was such a big fight over you know, moving in and even moving out. And here we are young, you know, you've got to break a lease. You have a baby. It's all mm-hmm. this stuff. So, yeah.
That was probably the hardest part as a mom to worry about your infant too, because
Absolutely.
Infants are innocent. They're
right.
great targets. And I mean, thankfully, and not, this is a bad way to put it, but thankfully the baby was spared of
yes.
the trauma
yes.
and everything else. Now, the cat was a whole different story, yes?
Yes, the cat was a different story. Cats, I mean, people don't give cats enough credit. Dogs, yes, they're very sensitive, but take a cat on an investigation, and boy, they'll tell you a lot. but seriously, the cat was affected, and I don't, you know, I as a mom, I was just trying to protect, mom instinct, trying to protect the baby. Trying to protect us and trying to protect my husband. But again, his will being broken, not really knowing why, and undermining me doing anything positive for him mm-hmm. With the priest really caused a situation. But, you know, I was at that point, I knew it was okay. My son's Jimmy. And I was like, it's Jimmy and I just have to make sure we live. And
right.
that's where the line was drawn in the sand. And there was just, you know, you can't rationalize any good coming out of that. But, and then to mention, so after Jim died, and this is mentioned in 207, his best friend would
yes.
go back to the apartment and sit in the apartment for hours. He worked mm-hmm. up the street from the apartment with my husband, and he would go at night, and it became a concern. And Jim came to me in August of 89 and told me that Jerry was going to do something to himself. And I reached out, and those people I really didn't know well, Jerry's girlfriend and whatnot, mm-hmm. but my close friends knew they need to listen. And it was like, I was pulling my hair out because I'm like, Jim said he's going to kill himself. And that was in August, and he did on November 1st. Mm-hmm. And it was after he came back from hanging out at the house at 207.
Mm-hmm. No, you can absolutely fall into that trap and, you know, follow suit in a sense. And it's really scary to know that, you know, because he was drawn in, basically. He was just drawn in. It was comfortable for him to be there. But I've read other accounts of similar instances where the person that has been oppressed or possessed, whichever you want to call it, when they had those moments of clarity, and they did apparently here and there, they knew that there was no other way out but to commit suicide.
Right, right. I, too, Jerry, Jim's best friend, and these names, minus Jim, a lot of the names were changed to protect the people because these people are alive. They know of the books. You know, it's very traumatic for everybody. Sarah, who is my good friend and babysitter in the book, my neighbor, very good friends of Jim and I, I am still in close contact with her and her their family. We consider each other family. And it's just, when you look at like how Jerry acted after he started staying at the house, he was talking to himself like Jim started doing, but he would do it. He would lock himself apparently in the bathroom and he would have a two-way conversation with somebody.
Right.
And so, you know, you always bring up mental health and things of that nature, but this was somebody again, who didn't have a history like that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's a very serious situation. So I just hope that through the darkness, like my family and I always say, that moment that my mother was able to reach him, you're talking, he was raving crazy. Nothing was the same about him in any normal given day that night, but what he said he was going to do and how he was going to do it and why he was going to do it. And then for her to connect with him on that real serious split, short, brief moment, we always say, for that moment, love won. There was something in him she connected that no matter what this evil thing was trying to get him to do this, he had enough power in him to fight that,
right,
to save us.
You know what it was? It was the power of love, because throughout it all, he loved you and your son. And sometimes that works.
Absolutely. And that's why we say it was love. Love won over evil.
Yeah.
In
and
that
it sounds
moment.
Cliche, but love, I think love is the strongest emotion in this world. I mean, they're all different types of love, but you know, love will, you know, surpass the bad sometimes.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it's funny because, again, so much of this book reminded me of things. Another one was when Chris felt like he was going to be thrown out the window or felt like he needed to jump. And I was on an investigation at one point at this very haunted house up in Hollywood, Mary Astor's old house.
Oh, I know where that is. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And as we walked through the house, they had the big French windows in most of the rooms. Mm-hmm. And we went into a bedroom that was kind of narrow, but the French windows were over on one side. And I started walking past the windows, and I had to pull myself away. I was afraid. I mean, not that I wasn't afraid. I didn't feel like anybody was going to push me, but I felt like I was compelled to almost jump. And they didn't have screens or anything, you know, old Hollywood house stuff. And that, you know, when I'm hearing about Chris standing at the window thinking he's going to get thrown out the window, I knew exactly how he felt because I backed away. There was a bed in the room on the other side of the wall. I just went and sat down because everybody was kind of sitting, hanging in there talking. And I wouldn't go near that window again. And I'm, you know, didn't sense anything horrible, but it's just like, you know.
Yeah. And it can happen just like that, just like you explained. It can be just you could be put in an environment and it has that ability to draw you or try to draw you in.
Right.
And that's kind of where you have to, you need to make up your mind. Are you going to run? And you stayed, which I do think is important. You stood your ground in a way. You removed yourself from the window.
Well,
but
yeah.
It's, that was good that you were able to control that. But people think it's hokey. It's not hokey. Not hokey at all.
No, it isn't. And I mean, the book is amazingly detailed. I mean, we've talked about it. We've kind of, you know, given away some of the what went on, but it's not you have to read the book to understand, to get the feeling of what was going on and the details and all these things. It's extremely compelling. And I'm going to get into book two very soon just to find out, because see, that's the other thing. People talk about locations and whatever. Mm-hmm. It's important to do your homework. It's important to find out the history of things. And what you've done in book two has validated everything that pretty much happened in book one, and book three is going to be the icing on the cake. I know, it's hard. It's long and drawn out and miserable, but it's important to do that. It brings clarity in many cases.
I agree. Yeah, you're right.
Not just to you, but it's just one of those weird things. I got a question from chat. Do you feel that Jim is at peace now?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. I think once you break those ties, maybe.
Well, I think what it was, in the book I describe what happened in August of 89. Jim appeared to me. I prayed for him. I was like, please let him go. Please, especially after the priest, you know, kind of went into what he thought happened. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And I was like, he didn't deserve this. He was a good man. He was a hardworking person. He was a great dad. He was a good husband. And I just prayed and prayed. And this one night he came to me, and I'm not going to get into what happened other than I knew at that moment he was free. Yeah. And I think what happens in these cases, and the more I've worked on cases and helped people, it's become pretty apparent. I think when evil does grab hold of somebody, you know that there is a mission, that they need the physical body to carry out acts. So once they are done with the physical body, that their host, let's say, there is a choice. I really think the good is let go. I think it's almost like a regurgitation. They don't need it anymore. If they were truly good, and it's, if they want to go, if spirit wants to go, they'll go. So I do think he was regurgitated, if you will, after he was used. But there are some cases, working as a medium and as an investigator, that the person, and you mentioned this earlier, there are evil or there are darker connotations to the personality where maybe they were not right. And so they don't get released. They're used as fuel.
Exactly. We're running quickly out of time. So what I'd like you to do is tell everybody where they can find your books to start with. Go ahead.
Sure. You can, the best place for resources, go to the website, JillMarieMorris.com, and you'll see the books page. You can get a brief summary on the books. You can order the books. You can go through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, so on and so forth. The tickets and events page is up. Lots of events are still being added. There is going to be one added for August for Hollywood. I'm looking forward to that.
Me too.
There are some other events that are going to be announced in time, but you can always go through the link to purchase the tickets. You don't purchase the tickets through me. You purchase it through the ticket people, the Eventbrite people. And basically at that point, you know, hopefully I can see some of you at book signings and events and whatnot. I'm always open to emails if you have a question or two, and that's it. I'm writing for Paranormal Underground. I've been writing for them since 2012, and I'm actually going to start writing for another Haunted Voices Radio is going to come out with a new magazine 3 times a year. So I'm going to be writing for that as well. So just, you can find me around.
You're also on Facebook. You have a fan page.
Yes.
You also have a YouTube channel.
I do.
Yeah, I know. We get so many things. You do have Twitter also. Whatever.
Exactly.
If people want to go to your website, that probably leads you everywhere else. Jill Marie Morris on Facebook, that'll pop up. So there's a lot of ways to find you. And I just want to say that we have to give Scott Michaels a plug, because the event that you're doing in August is at the Dearly Departed Tours and Museum. And it's a brand new Dearly Departed Tours and Museum. So even I haven't been there yet. I've got to get over there. So, I mean, and the other events, I looked at the event thing. You've got some back east. You've got them all over the place. So it's not like you have to come to California just to catch up with you. So look on the news and events page and send her an email through the events page, as she said, if you have any questions or whatever. And yeah, that about says it all. But honest to God, the books are great.
Thank you,
first
Marla.
Book, you know, held me. The second book is, I love the research part and all that. And I'm going to have to get the third book too. So it's one of those very well researched and put together and well written and easy to read. And I can't say enough good about it. But I will have to say that we have to get out of here. So thank you so much for joining me tonight. Come back and we'll talk about, you know, book two or book three and get that done. And I want to thank everybody for listening in tonight. Without you, you know, I'd be talking to myself or the cat, you know, that doesn't work quite as well. But until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
This has been another edition of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Be sure to tune in next week at this same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2014. Moonlight Hall by Kevin MacLeod, licensed through Incompetech.com.